Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, we will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, as I'm sure many of you expected to hear Marvin's voice with me this morning, I'm happy to announce that he will be back with us next week. And as usual, he's out there doing wonderful things to help other families. Now, our guest today, Keith Dorsch, is the creator of The Communication Cure, an internet-based tool that builds relationships through meaningful talk. Now, having been on the show previously, Keith has shared with me that he is first and foremost a husband of over 20 years and a very proud father of six children, ages, I think, 19 to 7 years old. So it's quite a spread. Professionally, Keith has guided over 375 couples through week-long relationship-building intensives and has spent over 20,000 hours helping families and individuals heal from life's pains and grow to reach their full potential in life. Keith's successful approach and tools for resolving communication problems has earned the praise of doctors, teachers, army chaplains, and therapists around the continent. Keith, welcome back to Answers for the Family.
Well, thank you, Alan. I'm really excited to be here with you this morning.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. I've had opportunities to go to the website, to go to the Communication Cure, and I really love the fact that what you have is something that is, it's very simple. It's really kind of, it provides something, I think, for everybody. And for those of us in this very fast-paced life that we've chosen to take on, there's no books to read. There's no real complicated teaching methods, and it's not a how-to program. It just sort of models communication and allows those of us to pick up tips and traits or things that we think would be of value. So I want to thank you for that, because I think you really put something out there that can help everybody, no matter where they're at in their level of communication.
Yeah, I get excited every time I get feedback from people who use that resource. Seeing it, they know it has potential, and then when they use it, they're often very appreciative, and they say the relationships have changed. So that's what I'm about, seeing relationships grow stronger and improve. We got enough stress out there in life that we need some real good support to help us get through it.
I couldn't agree more. So let's sort of go back to the beginning, and I know some of these answers, but I don't know that our listeners today know. But share how your interest in helping others experience meaningful talk. How did that develop for you? Because I think that's an area that a lot of people don't really understand. And I think at times I find, because I travel, I'll go to places and I'll talk to people and I'll realize there's a lot of people that have learned how to, for lack of better terms, talk about stuff that doesn't matter, or just this sort of, the old how's the weather type of thing. And there isn't really a lot of meaning in it. And so tell me, what occurred that, or what was mm-hmm. your experience that made you decide, okay, I'm going to focus on meaningful talk?
Right. Well, when I was married, I've been married to Nancy now 20 years, and I had to learn to communicate. I thought I was pretty good at it. I had no clue how poor I was. I grew up, I realize now, growing up, whenever there was any conflict in my home, I would just pull away and shut down. I would literally go in my bedroom and close the door and say to myself, I wish, you know, this parent would ask me this question. And then here's what I would say back to them. And then they would ask me this question. I would say this back. And I played entire conversations in my head, but I wasn't having the conversation. And there's a big difference, because there's a real fear barrier that needs to be crossed to enter into the conversation. So it was a pseudo conversation. It was very one-sided. It was all me, but I thought it was taking care of me at the time. And I never was forced into situations where I had to communicate about things that I should have been communicating about. I had great friendships and we could talk, but in the more meaningful conversations that need to occur, I always pulled away from. And so I couldn't do that when I got married. I met my wife. She was interviewing me to work with her brother who's special needs. And I went home from the interview and called my friend. I said, I met the girl I'm going to marry. And Nancy was not thinking along those lines at all. She was just looking for someone who would be a good support for her brother. Anyways, within a year, we were married, which goes against every piece of counseling advice I've ever given, Alan. It's just, I can't believe I did that. And so working with her brother really closely, I found out some things about Nancy. She had an eating disorder from the age of 5. She has really damaged her body bad because of that. So I took her to a doctor, and he gave her 6 months to live. And on top of that, she was having a lot of panic attacks and body memories and strange stuff I had never encountered. And I could not run away from meaningful conversation any longer. It was her taking off, threatening to disappear, and me just crawling in bed and putting the covers over my head and hoping she'd come back. And I realized, wow, I have no ability here to connect with someone who I love tremendously and really needs some help and support right now. And so I was forced into learning how to engage in really challenging situations, how to talk to a person who's in a panic attack, and then talk about what are the things going on that are leading to the addiction and leading to the panic attacks and the depression and the suicidal thoughts and all that, and have those conversations, and then confront my own fears of having those conversations and my own inadequacies, because, you know, newly married, you want to be the man and be everything your wife needs you to be, and it's pretty painful to realize that you're in a vulnerable position where you may not be able to help her. So we worked at building our relationship, and that came all through communication, and I learned some stuff in that I then applied in my own counseling with people. And then further down the road, develop the communication cure that makes all that stuff available to people at home. So rough start in the marriage, but like I said, 20 years, and you nailed it. It's quite a spread. Age 7 to 19 years old with kids. I've got, they're like 19, 17, 15, 13, 11, and 7. So a bunch of teenagers and a few young ones still. And I love... I really like when they enter the teen years, because I think the conversation gets a lot richer. And not that it's not important when they're young, but there's a lot of topics to be discussing when they're teenagers. So I really like where I'm at with the stage in family. It's helped me keep me accountable that what I teach people, I put into practice at home myself.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like you're having to deal with, you know, two or three different stages all at the same time, depending on which child you're with. So you got to really stay on your toes. Now, you know, when you mentioned something about in the beginning with you and your wife, and I don't know if there are other listeners that are thinking this, but one of the thoughts that came to mind for me was, on the one hand, there is that point in which you have to say to yourself, okay, I have to be a better communicator, or I have to be able to do this stuff. How do you now also tell this person that you love that it's something that they have to do as well, without them taking it as they're being blamed for everything that's going on.
Boy, that's exactly what goes on. And the default is blame. And to talk to them, there needs to be, you know, that connection. And really, when I talk about communication, I'm really talking about connecting with a person where they know that they are safe. And along with, you know, whether it's my wife or somebody else, anyone who's struggling with an addiction probably doesn't realize that they're also struggling with a maturity issue, because a mature person knows how to take care of themselves. So does a person with full maturity involve themselves in addictions or self-harm or things like that? And they really don't. They replace that with other healthy, mature habits. So I had an understanding of maturity that helped me approach her and also work with my kids, you know, from about age four, when kids start stringing four words together. I think it's, you know, two words when they're two, three words when they're three, four when they're four, is when they can start appropriately asking for things that they need. If a kid is whining, I'll have a kid come to me and whine and complain about something another sibling did, and I'll just say, "Do you need something?" And they're like, "Yeah, I do." "Oh, what do you need?" And they can tell me very clear and very appropriately, "Well, I need them to not go in my room without permission or not asking." And I'll say, "Well, how do you ask for that?" And they'll tell me. I'll say, "Go do that." And if it doesn't work, then they can appeal to me as a parent, but I want them to try first. And the same thing with adults. I communicate to them that, and to Nancy, I was communicating that I want to help you. I am here. I am available. I need you to ask for some of the things you need in an appropriate way, and you'll see that I want to help you. I'm from originally Canada, and there's a lot of hockey up there. And sometimes when there's immature communication of needs, I say it feels like you got a hockey stick in the back of the knees, and you're down on your knees. You know, when you're taxing, "You never do this for me. You don't do this." But then there's that request for help. Well, you don't feel like helping because you've just been hacked at the knees. And that's the immaturity showing up. How can I ask for what I need in a way that keeps the person there in a responsive position towards me, wanting to help me? And I help people do that. I practice it. And it's you know, because it's a part of maturity, it fits, it registers with people. And so when they get treated that way, it's like two puzzle pieces coming together and the light goes on and go, "Oh, this is how I can do it as well." Because maturity is caught, not taught. And so through experience, these other situations, the people would develop their skills in communication.
Now, I know that you had another situation that influenced you and furthered your understanding of communication. Share a little bit about the situation with your daughter.
Sure. Yeah, I'll do that one quick. It's an important one. One of my daughters, from about 18 months on, had seizures, and they were really irregular. They could be a couple in a week. We could go 7 months with nothing. But there are some symptoms around them that were always common. They were always around sleep. Whether she was waking up in the morning or falling asleep at night, they would occur then. She was always really hungry for a couple days before and would just pretty much camp out at the fridge and eat everything. And she'd have really bad eye pain, and she'd have struggles with bladder control. And so finally we went to a doctor who's a functional neurologist who studies how the brain works, and he has 4 years of additional neurological studies on top of chiropractic. And he said all of those symptoms are signs of a weak brain stem. He said, because your brain stem does those primal functions, so vision, hunger, bladder control, sleep, all that type of thing. And he said that if she has a weak brain stem, she won't be able to raise her eyebrows, because that's the part of your body that raises your eyebrows. And nobody knows that. And I paid the $80 an hour, so everybody now can know that. And I'm giving you that information for free. So you can try raising your eyebrows, and if you can, you got a good brain stem, and some of those core functions are working well. But she could not raise hers. All she could do is open her mouth and tilt her head back, but there was no raising of the eyebrows. He said the brain only responds to input. And so there's a nerve that gives direct input to the brainstem. And he took a Kleenex, which is very light, stroked the left side of her face, and that stimulated the nerve to her brainstem. And he said, "Now raise your eyebrows." And she was able to raise her eyebrows perfectly. And we were blown away. And so that started much greater understanding and study into the brain, and I was recognizing more how certain parts of the brain can be overactive and underactive, and how they can, in my daughter's case, result in seizures. In other people's cases, it can result in memory problems. But I really started applying it to relationships. I thought, what about the relationship circuitry in our brain? What if it is underactive? Are people going to be able to engage with other people in conversation? You know, too quickly, fears will come in, or feelings of rejection will come in. And what happens is you have circuitry in your brain that shuts down, and you stop being relational. And when you're not being relational, you might be talking to somebody, but you're not relating to them as an equal, as a peer, as another human being. And so you get into maybe name calling, and you talk to people in ways that you would never want to be talked to. That's all a sign that your relationship circuitry in your brain is not powered up and as strong as it could be. And so that'll definitely affect people's abilities to communicate and engage and respond with love in conversation.
I'm amazed. I mean, as you're saying that, you know, I'm raising my eyebrows. I'm envisioning people out there driving in their cars right now, raising their eyebrows and going, "Oh, okay, my brainstem's just fine."
Yeah, that's right. You know, and one of the things with her story is one day she had a seizure, and the doctor asked my wife, "Did you notice anything different?" And my wife said, "Well, actually, she had a hard time lowering her eyebrows." And he goes, "Well, that's a different brain part." It's like, oh boy. So he gave us exercises to strengthen that part of the brain. And so it's, you know, it's very complicated. There's many areas involved, especially, you know, in relationship, different parts that you can have overactive or underactive, and you want to get them all functioning just right.
Wow. Now, I know that you do a lot of work with families, and a lot of the families that that listen to the show or that send in questions and stuff are dealing with their teens at this point. So in your work with families, can you tell us a little bit about the techniques that you teach the parents to use that will help their teens consider, discover, and refine their own unique traits and talents?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I teach the parents, and I don't do a lot of teaching because I've seen that when the brain is functioning as it should and communication is happening as it should, things just flow well. We don't need more education. We need more experience. But one of the key things I teach parents these days is that they are responsible for their own behaviors, their own feelings, and their own thoughts. And that likewise, their teenagers, you know, as they are getting closer to being launched into life, take on a lot more responsibility, specifically for their actions. You know, the two-year-old, your parents can be more responsible for the child's actions, but it's not their thoughts and feelings. But as kids and teenagers are getting older, they are responsible for their behaviors, thoughts, and actions. And I find a lot of conflict is when parents aren't handing over the actions to the teens early enough in life to help them, you know, maybe make a mistake when it's still not too costly and learn from it and actually own the decision-making process. And so once parents can back away from that, then they're free to actually enjoy their teenager and know them and have a relationship with them versus just having them behave a certain way, which typically, and I know it because I'm a parent, typically is a little bit selfish on the parents' part, is we don't want our kids messing up. Yes, we don't want them hurt, but also we don't want some of the consequences and extra work it puts on us. So we stop looking at the child and fully and consider more of our own agenda in a situation. But once the parent can say, okay, your choices are going to be your choices. And there's some things around that if the teen's living at home that, you know, you just don't let everything happen. But you free them up enough that they actually want to talk to you because they know, hey, if I'm going to talk to mom and dad, this isn't going to be about them controlling me, telling me what I need to do, but they just want to get to know me. In fact, last week I had a whole family, in my office, parents, several teenagers, and the oldest one had according to the parents, compromised the family values and gotten into some behaviors the first year of college that they felt were wrong for this child and detrimental to the child. And I would have agreed and supported with them totally, but it became such a point of contention. Everything revolved around their daughter and their dating relationships. So what I did is, before I even got on the topic, I went to the Communication Cure resource and pulled up the talk on dating. And I said, I am so confident that you as a family can work through these issues and have enjoyable relationships that before I even work with you at all, I'm going to have you guys have a conversation on dating. And they looked at me like, what? That's our big problem. And so I said, here's how you use this tool. You're going to answer the questions that are asked, face each other, answer the questions. When you're done answering, advance to the next question. I'm going to walk out of the room. And when you're done, just open the door. Well, it was about 35 minutes. They opened the door. I walked back in, and they were both in the chairs. Their eyes were swollen and red. They had Kleenex in their hands. There was Kleenex on the floor. They had been crying, and I didn't have to ask, but I asked, how was that? And they said, wow, we just talked about the hardest thing, and our hearts opened to each other, and I just really want to keep going with it. And then the next day, they reported back how the daughter just opened up driving home about a new interest she had as far as a boyfriend went, something she would have never shared before. But they had that safe environment. And really that talk was getting to know the teenager's opinions, mm-hmm. views, you know, moving away from what the exact issue and topic of conflict is and get to know the child around that particular topic. And how can we talk about dating? How can we talk about drinking and drugs in a way that our teenagers are open to us? That's what that tool does. And after that, after they used that tool, I was able to talk to them about absolutely everything and anything and really made progress.
Well, and I think that is beautiful. And part of it is that when you started to tell the story, it was the family, the adults anyway, and the family were upset about her actions and how it reflected on the family. So again, it goes to that point of they're more concerned with how this reflects on them than really sitting down with their daughter to find out what's going on with her. And I love the way you handled it. You got them to look at something else first and then realize that maybe the way that this reflects on the family isn't the biggest situation right now. It's not what we should be focused on. So I think that's
good. And the other thing I'll add is that they realized the daughter's actions were not a true reflection of her heart. And it's very easy for parents to look at the actions, and if it's something we don't agree with or we think it brings a consequence to it, we think it's wrong, and we have a difficult time separating the child, the teenager's heart from their actions. And this allowed them to say, hey, you know what, my daughter isn't doing this out of rebellion. There's other stuff going on, and hey, I want to help her with that.
I love it. Now, and you also mentioned earlier in regards to maturity and thinking of it more from a husband and wife situation, my guess would be that same situation probably occurs when you have this parent that's not dealt with that their own maturity level when they're now trying to deal with their teenager. Now, is that, in other words, in that scenario, you know, what does the brain require to function optimally, not only in relationships with your spouse, but also, with your teenagers,
right.
so that you can then effectively work with them. But in many cases, I'm guessing you need to kind of work with what your issues are first.
Exactly. I think what I've seen is that as soon as the conflict really takes a jump in a relationship, it's usually an indication that now the people have matched maturity levels. So when a teenager and a parent are really unable to resolve conflict, it's a reflection that, hey, parent, your maturity level now has dropped and become the same level as your teenager, and you're not going to work through any conflict, and you're not going to build any relationship. So our brains need a few things at that time. Information isn't quite so important, but one thing we need to look at brain-wise is, do we have an example? So do we have another parent out there who we can picture in our minds handling a situation with a teenager better than we currently are, and say, hey, what would Alan do in this situation with his teenager? How would he talk to them? And just forming that picture in our mind will change chemistry and how the neurons fire and equip you then to pull the trigger and exemplify that yourself in your own relationship. So having an example is really important. And then being able to say, to have someone else that you can talk to the problems that you have that are hindering your relationship with your teenager. Don't talk about your teenager's problems, but have another adult that you can talk to who can hear it, what you're going through, and not, you know, partner with your anxiety and partner with your fears and support it, but actually just, you know, affirm it and say, I can understand why you'd be as worried as you are about your child or your teenager, but you know what? You can do this well, and you need that connection with another individual. And a lot of people don't have that. A lot of times in their immaturity, they find someone that they can just go and complain about their teenager, and that's not what they need. They need someone who can validate what they're struggling with as a parent and encourage them that they can get through it and do it in a way that builds the relationship with their teenager.
Yeah, I think that makes good sense. I know that in many cases when we're talking to a parent, I will recognize that they seem to be looking for somebody to just validate what their reaction has been to whatever situation that we're brought into. And that's the one issue. And then the other issue is that I start to feel the embarrassment, you know, where the parent is feeling embarrassed and not really opening up about what's really going on. And one of the tools that we use is, you know, I'll stop them for a minute and then say, you know, let me tell you a story. And when one of my children was still 8 years old, and I would say, you would probably have a better ability to get my 8 year old to go to bed at 8 o'clock. Because for me, it's, can you read me another story? Can I have another glass of milk? Can you bring me some water? Can you rub my back? Something that keeps doing it, because they know my buttons and they know that they can push those. And that, so I try to make that parent feel less embarrassed about their situation by saying, you know, my child doesn't know your buttons. So this is why you're talking to me and why we're going to be showing up in the morning to pick up your child and say, take them to a program, because your child doesn't know our buttons. You know, so, you know, there isn't that emotional attachment. And, you know, as the child's trying to push those buttons, you know, by the time they start to figure a few things out, we're already at the program. And they're now with professionals who are going to start working with them on their particular issues.
Yeah, that's great. Good story.
So now, you know, how are our abilities to communicate in a meaningful way affected by things like empathy or sympathy or compassion? Do you have something that demonstrates the relationship between all of these?
I do. I've got a story that I've shared in the past on that. Do we have enough time?
Yes, we do.
For a break?
Actually, you know what? I love the way you're thinking. Now that we have their attention,
okay.
Now that we have their attention,
yes.
Let's take a break. Stay with us. And in fact, as we go to break, let me also tell everybody, for those of you that can, you can go to thecommunicationcure.com. If you go to the website, you can open it up, you can open another window, and you can literally follow along with us. Now, again, don't try this if you're driving, but, you know, open up a window on your computer and follow along with us. But stay with us, because we will be right back in 1 minute. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry.
Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And you're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Keith Dorsch, and we're talking about the communication cure. Now, when we went to break, we were talking about how our abilities to communicate in a meaningful way is affected by empathy, sympathy, and compassion. And Keith is going to demonstrate, he's got a story to demonstrate a little bit about the relationship between these three areas.
All right. It's called My Best Day in Grade 9 Ever, and it occurred when I was 45. Not that I was that much of a struggling student, but I was invited into a Grade 9 co-ed health class at a local high school to share. And so when you think of meaningful communication, you'll think for yourself, but I want the listeners to think, what would meaningful communication be for me? What would that look like? And I think it would be, I thought immediately today of when I was leaving and my wife was leaving the house at the same time today, and she said, "I love you," to me. That was meaningful, hearing that. Being listened to and feeling listened to, is meaningful. Being validated, someone saying, "I understand." Imagine if you're a husband and you just kind of lost it on one of the kids. And Nancy did this to me once. She walked up to me one time after I got upset with one of the kids, and she kind of got on me about it. And I just walked away. I went in my office and closed the door. Not a good example. A few days later, I blew it again with a kid, and she walked up to me, and she whispered in my ear, "I know you didn't want to do what you just did." And she walked away. I was like, I wanted to chase her down. I wanted to keep talking. This is great. That was meaningful communication to me. Nice. She showed understanding and being encouraged and being supported. Well, really, all of those things that make up meaningful communication are an expression of love. And we don't very often get to a place where we can exhibit love to the people around us. And that's because it requires empathy first, then sympathy, and then compassion. Compassion is the last response in our brains to what we see in the people around us. But there has to be that empathy. So empathy happens in a sixth of a second. And it's feeling that that person you're with is a safe person. If you're with somebody and you can tell in a sixth of a second, faster than you can think, if they're upset with you, if they're angry, or if they're indifferent or reject you, forget it, you don't connect. But if you can connect with them and say, "Hey, this is a safe person," then you can move to sympathy, and that's where you ask questions and find out what's going on. And as you find out what's going on with them and what their views are on something and just communicate, then your brain starts working in the background going, "Hey, how can I show compassion to this person? How can I see a need and meet that need verbally or doing something physically, a hug, something like that?" And so I was sharing with these students that that's how your brain functions, and it's never fun when you get a solution but you don't have the heart behind it. There's not it's just the solution. A lot of wives tell me they get it from their husbands. "I get the solution to my problem. I never feel listened to." So there's never that meaningful communication. So at the end of the class, after I teach a bit, I take two students and I face them on chairs, knee to knee, facing each other, and the rest of the class makes a circle around them, and they're listening very closely. So this is not a private exercise at all. It's very public, and it's, again, remember, a grade 9 health class. And so I had two boys, and I would give one boy the question out loud, and he would look at the other student, and he would repeat after me, and he would ask that same question. And people go, "Well, that's pretty sterile. I don't see that working." But if it's a good question, it registers in the speaker's eyes, and it comes out their eyes, and so that listener says, hey, this person really wants to know, and I just had him ask a few questions where I knew the guy would be interested in, and it started creating a connection between them, and we got to a point where the student who was answering the questions shared that he's from a military family and moved around a whole lot, and just so much so that this year at his new school, he wasn't going to make any friends because he didn't want to go through leaving them again and losing them, basically shutting his heart down to relationship. And so I had the asking student ask him, well, how do you feel walking the halls of Liberty High School? And the student opened up and said, I feel alone. Mm. And alone is the most intense pain a person can feel. It's most challenging to resolve, and he is saying, here I am, I'm a youth, I'm only in ninth grade, but I'm struggling with feeling alone, and he shared it in front of his whole class. And then I had the other student ask him, how do you deal with the pain of feeling alone? And the student replied, I go home and cut myself every night. And then his eyes just went wide, and he gasped, and he's like, I can't believe I said that. And he started panicking in front of the class, and I quickly said to the class, if you have more respect for him now than you did a moment ago, because he's been open and honest with you, stand up. And the whole class stood up and clapped for this guy. Calmed the situation down. We continued talking. We found out that he had more areas of pain in his life. He had some really challenging relationships with his sisters at home. They were pretty mean to him. And he was carrying just a lot of pain inside. And so there was an empathetic connection made. There was sympathy. There was understanding. And so as an act of compassion, I said to the class, if you want to figuratively carry a piece of this guy's pain out this classroom door so he doesn't have to carry so much pain in his life, stand up. Again, the whole class stood up and clapped, saying, we don't want you to carry the pain. And that was an expression of love. But I kind of orchestrated that. Shortly after, I was talking to the teacher, and I saw another student who was part of the circle walk up to that student with all the pain. And he said to him, I have you in my Spanish class after health class. Can I walk with you so you don't have to feel alone? And I thought, wow, there is the potential we have when we can make a connection, a meaningful connection, communicate. We will get loving responses. They will just be offered. And you'll overcome all the fears. You know, this kid overcame probably the thought of what will people say if I go, what if he thinks I'm stupid going up and asking him, what if people make fun of me in the halls. He did not care, and he did what was right and what was loving and what probably made a significant change in that student's life that day as he walked the halls not feeling alone. And I just want to see more families, spouses, parents, teens, parents, children giving that love to each other. But you need to spend some time nurturing that connection and the communication so that there's that meaningful, loving response.
Yeah, that I love the story. It is beautiful, and it really touches on that point to where we need to give them the not only the freedom but the comfort zone that they need to be able to open up like that. I just, again, it's beautiful. And if we can focus on that and not focus so much on how this relates to us, you know, just focus on the fact of what can we do for them to, as you said, help carry this pain. I love it. Let me just kind of change gears a little bit. We mentioned earlier, and I had asked if, you know, what else you have going on, because I know that you also have speaking engagements and such. Now, with some of these, and I know you've been doing quite a few of them this summer, and you're speaking to both youth and parents. Share with us a little bit about what you have been sharing with them, because I know that, if I'm correct, it has something to do with this new movie that's out right now. So share with us a little bit about some of the key things that you're getting from this movie and how it's helping youth and parents.
I'm so glad that Disney came out with Inside Out this summer, because it is a movie all about emotions. And I didn't read the movie reviews, cinematic reviews on it. I went to the psychological journals and said, what are they saying about it? Because I felt like they were getting it right as far as they presented how emotions guide our lives. And the psychological journals were saying, yeah, they've got it right. And it went along with much of what I teach and how that joy is such an important part. You know, I said people need to connect. And you're going to connect with people who you know are glad to be with you. And that's really what joy is. And we need to experience that as the most common experience, feeling. We just need to know that that's normal. It is normal to be with people who are glad to be with you. And anything less than that, there's a problem, and we need to find some way to resolve that. So this movie presents the emotion of joy working with four other emotions, fear, sadness, anger, and disgust, which are emotions that we're hardwired with. And when we don't have much joy in our life, if we're not with people who are communicating, they're glad to be with us, then fear can increase and take on more power and control in a situation than is really necessary. We only need fear when our life is on the line, whether it's a health or safety issue, when a car comes at you and you got to jump out of the way. You know, that's the proper role of fear. But when you come home and sit around the dining room table, even if you do, maybe you don't. Maybe there's families that just sit in front of the TVs or are not eating together. And some of that is because fear. Well, fear has too much control in your life. And so this summer, I've been speaking at a lot of different teen camps and to adults on how we need to find people that are glad to be with us and associate with them more. We need to remember those people that we've had in our life and be thankful for them, not think of the loss if we've lost a loved one or if someone has moved, but be thankful for that person who has been glad to be with us. And that will help whether we have anxiety, worry. I think of kids going back to school right now. You know, in my part of the country, they've been back for 2-3 weeks now. And there's a lot of anxiety about class and what's going to be going on. And a good strategy there is to remember those people who are glad to be with you. Some of those times from the summer where you had good times with maybe relatives, cousins, grandparents, and think of those times walking into a class, and you'll actually walk in there a whole lot calmer than you would. And then sadness is represented in that movie, and sadness is also a healthy emotion. When we lose something that's part of our life, we can breathe it. We can go through a process of sadness with it. We don't want to get angry that we've lost it. We don't want to get depressed and push emotions and feelings away and try not to feel. We want to say, I'm sad that I've lost that. And find someone who's glad to be with you. Find someone who you can connect with. Share with something that you've lost and let them just talk with you about it and grieve it. It's a very important piece. Most of the counseling I do really doesn't come because people are saying, hey, I've lost something in my life. But along the way, you see where they've lost stuff. They've lost their innocence. They've lost their confidence. They've lost people who love them. And their responses to it have made things difficult. But if we can just grieve that type of thing, people are going to be a whole lot healthier. And so I would teach this to the teens and the parents this summer. But then I would give them conversations to have to pair off and a series of questions where they could actually talk with another human being about times of joy. And we started there and we talked about thankfulness. Then we talked about some things that they've lost in life and the sadness and sharing that with another person who cared about them. And the response is these were kids who had done a 5-day outdoor adventure camp. So one day they were rock climbing. One day they were rappelling. One day they climbed a 14er mountain. Another day they whitewater rafted. Another day they did a ropes course. And every night that I spoke, people said, this was the best thing of the whole week. And I'm thinking, that whitewater rafting in Colorado is pretty fun. But their deeper need was to let go of these burdens. And they said, we've had these burdens I've been carrying around. And another guy said, I've been best friends with this guy for 6 years. And having this 20-minute talk tonight with him, I feel I know him better than I ever have in the last 2 years. And people just don't make time for this. So I was not just teaching. I give them an opportunity to experience it and have the meaningful conversation. And the weights are lifted off these kids and off the parents as they say, hey, I can connect with my teen. I don't have to be afraid of them. I just need a little help and support to get there.
Well,
great to watch.
count me in when you have your next one. But it does pose, as far as the question, that in this day and age in which there is a lot of focus on connecting, and supposedly all of these incredible ways to connect with people all over the world, why do you think that there's so many people struggling with disconnection and communication and as a result, living a life in relationships that are difficult or in conflict?
Mm. You know, you said it. There's so many ways to connect. I call it pseudo-connection. If you can share it, like it, pin it, post it, snap it, chat it. I don't know what those things are called. But that is what people consider connecting today, and it's their number of friends that they have, a number of followers, and none of it provides the connection that our brains are wired to have. And so it's really unfortunate that people are being really buying into a big lie that this is connection. There's nothing worse than texting. You know, if you want to miscommunicate what you're thinking and what you're feeling, go ahead and text a person. You know, I'm working on that with all my teens now, and how much texting they want to do. And they tell me, "Oh, Dad, you know, it's our generation. You just didn't have this." And I'm like, you know what? It's still not an effective way to develop and maintain friendships with people. It's not a true connection. They say about 3% of what you want to communicate gets communicated through a text. Uh-huh. 3% of what you want comes through in a text. And I say that, you know, depending what they're in, if they're, I got a couple of girls that are in dance, and I said, would you want to go into a performance, ballet, in front of an audience if you were feeling at 3% of health? Imagine being 97% sick, fever, sore throat, watery eyes, sprained mm-hmm. ankle. Do you want to go into your dance performance? And it's like, no way, Dad. I said, well, you're doing your relationships like that when you're using these forms to connect. And people are getting so used to it so quickly, it's unfortunate that when they are encouraged to sit down within 3 feet of an actual physical person and make eye contact, they're uncomfortable. And because they're uncomfortable, they think it's wrong. And because mm-hmm. they have some maturity issues, they say, hey, I don't like anything that's uncomfortable. I just want to do what's comfortable in life. And they avoid connecting and being in those relationships. I wish, Alan, we could find a way to reverse that and get people to really appreciate the need we have to have face-to-face communication. And that's what'll make it meaningful.
Well, you have started that, and I'm looking at the time. We've only got about 2 minutes, but if we can use that to share with our listeners about the communication cure. For those that haven't gone to the site, share with them as to what it is and how it can be used. You know, and in fact, and I was just noticing, I mean, and, you know, it is a very unique resource. So if you can share with them a little bit about that, and again, for everybody sure. out there, you know, if you go to thecommunicationcure.com, either now or right after the show, you can learn more about it. Or if you're unable to write that down, go to our answersforthefamily.com site, and there's information on how you can link directly to the communication cure. So go ahead.
Great. Yeah, if they visit that site, they can sign up and get 3 free talks. And that's more than a conversation starter. A conversation starter says, here's your problem, you don't know how to ask a question. Well, that's not our problem. Our problem is when the conversation goes any further than that, emotions can kick in and the conversation can start to deteriorate. So I've created an online computer-based tool that has anywhere from 9 to 20-something questions on a specific topic, like dating or approachability, which is a conversation you could have with your teen. And you log in, you purchase the package if you want the parent teen or the parent child. You log in, and then you pick the topic you want to talk on. And I tell my kids, just randomly pick a number, 1 to 20, just so there's absolutely no agenda. They pick a number, we click on that talk, and it asks the questions. It tells us who's going to be answering and who's going to be listening, and it asks the questions, and everything about it is so intentional. The voice, the audio track is from a a guy who is chosen by a board of functional neurologists saying this guy has the voice that calms the amygdala in the brain. The background music is licensed from Gary Lamb and Stanton Lanier, and they've written their music to mimic a heartbeat at rest and lower blood pressure. So there's music playing in the background, the questions asked, and then the teen just, or the child or the spouse, answers the question with the computer there, and the other participant just sits and listens to the answer. And it breaks some of the bad habits we have of formulating our answers while we're listening. And it causes us just to listen, because this person is going to answer 15 or so questions in a row. And then partway through it might reverse, and the adult gets a chance to share some of their answers with the teen. And you have a mutually satisfying conversation. Mutually satisfying is really important for maturity.
Uh-huh.
And a conversation is important because we just don't want to be about functional stuff, where we need to go, who we need to be with. So families can purchase this package. The whole thing is the price of one counseling session. So if you're going to go to one counseling session, who are you going to take? Your spouse, your teen, or your kid? And you're only going to get one session with them. I want people talking so they can get 30 talks for marriages, 20 talks with teens, and 20 talks with children for the price of a counseling session. And it's all reusable. So you can come back in 3 months and talk to your child about school, or talk about stress in their life, or talk about how to make your family a better family, and hear from them. And the structure that we provide with the communication cure allows them to bring their life to it and have a totally new, meaningful conversation every time you have it. One thing I want to add, because I've created a very important, necessary talk on terrorism, because kids are seeing stuff, they're seeing it, they're hearing it, and as parents, we think, you know what, if my kid's not talking about it, it mustn't be weighing on their minds. And I'm telling you, it is weighing on their minds, even when they go to school. So the website is terrorism.meaningfultalk.com, and it's a free talk. I encourage everyone to go there and have it. And it's really for children's age. You can start at 5 and go up to 12 or so. But you're going to talk about what terrorism is at their level. And everyone, all the experts say, you know, what's most important is that your child feels safe talking about it. And it provides that safe environment. So with ISIS and all those groups out there doing horrific things and things to children, our kids need to know that they're safe, and you're going to get that through meaningful talk with them. So please go to terrorism.meaningfultalk.com and spend a few moments to take care of your kids.
Keith, thank you so much for coming on again. You know, I feel like I'd like to schedule, you know, we need to schedule maybe every 6 months or so, because you always have so much great information. This new thing on terrorism, I wish we had more time, because I completely agree with you and I'd love to go deeper in it. But thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
I look forward to it too, Alan. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And for everybody out there, please tune in next week when our guest Lisa Garr joins us to discuss becoming aware, how to repattern your brain and revitalize your life. And remember, if you miss a show or you want to share this show with friends, please visit our archives at answersforthefamily.com. And next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by and like our page. Be with us again each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Bye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.